This week on Behind the Lens. A project to install lead and microbe water filters at local schools has run into a problem: insufficient water pressure. Also, Mayor LaToya Cantrell was in Baton Rouge this week to broker a deal on a series of bills that would send more money to the city for infrastructure repairs. One of those bills deals with a tax increase on short-term rentals. We'll have the details. And a major shakeup for local news in Southeast Louisiana. Owners of The Advocate have purchased NOLA.com, the Times-Picayune. I'll talk with veteran journalist and Lens opinion editor Jed Horn about what this means for journalism in New Orleans. I'm Jessica Rosegard. You're listening to Behind the Lens, a podcast by The Lens.
Brought to you by community support. Learn more at support.thelensnola.org.
The Orleans Parish School Board has been installing lead and microbe-removing water filters at all city schools. Installation began late last summer, but has been delayed because water pressure in many schools isn't adequate enough for the filters to work properly. Joining me is Marta Jusen. Marta, what prompted the Orleans Parish School Board to install lead and microbe-removing water filters at city schools?
That's going to take us all the way back to 2016. When Michigan officials were indicted for Flint's lead and water crisis, the district came out and said, hey, we're going to test all the water in city schools. They didn't end up doing that, and they decided they were going to install filters instead. And that project has kind of been just ongoing and slow moving for the last couple years.
So they skipped testing altogether?
Correct. To our knowledge, last time the schools were tested, other than Plessy recently, was in the late 80s.
So why did they backtrack from this happened in Flint, we're going to test all the water, to we're not going to test the water, we're just going to install filters?
They decided after speaking with experts that it was a safer solution to install filters because that was going to protect long-term against lead, whereas a test, even if it did give you a positive reading, was only giving you a moment in time. And advocates and parents and a lot of people actually support this decision, although now they're frustrated because it's taking so long to install the filters.
Yeah, you discovered in your reporting that there's a water pressure problem with the filters. Explain the problem and how you uncovered it.
Under the Louisiana Public Records Law, we requested email communication between Eco Water Systems, which is the contractor, and the school board. And it just led to a revelation of issues that are kind of ongoing. So we learned that low water pressure meant that the filters wouldn't work. They require 60 to 80 PSI. Sewer and Water Board is only required to put out 20 PSI, pounds per square inch of water pressure. And in the older schools, they have low water pressure because they don't have booster pumps within the buildings. So now the district has to order booster pumps for individual drinking fountains.
And the necessary amount of pounds per square inch of water pressure is basically to push the water through these filters with enough power to clean out the stuff it's supposed to clean out.
Correct. And so they don't need this high of a water pressure if they only had a lead-only filter, but they wanted to add that microbe filter so that they could still have school on boil water advisory days.
So you said the water pressure problem is more of an issue with this microbe-removing filter than it is with the lead filter. And the microbe filter would be so that kids can still drink school water during a boil advisory. It seems to me that the lead filter would be the immediate concern. Boil advisories happen, but not every day, thankfully. So has there been any discussion about stepping back the program in that sense?
There has not been any public discussion, but these emails did reveal that they considered dropping to lead-only filters as a possible option. But one of the other employees in the district's facilities office got worried about it because they had requested the microbe filters. So to change the contract at this point in time would probably delay installation even further.
So how is this issue of inadequate water pressure impacting schools' ability to install the filters?
So the district can't put in these filters because it slows down the water so much that then drinking fountains are only operating at a trickle. Obviously, we don't want kids with their mouths all over drinking fountains. But newer schools already have booster pumps within the building, so those schools are able to have filters installed. Although we learned that even the plan to install the filters in the newer school isn't quite working out. Lake Forest had to have their filters turned off because drinking fountain pressure wasn't high enough. This week we found out that Bricolage, even though they have 18 filters installed, only 17 are actually connected, according to documents that we saw. And then a photo that we got shows that while the filters are mounted in there and they look like they would be connected, there is no connection to the drinking fountain.
You said that installation of these filters has been more successful at newer schools, but older schools are perhaps the ones who need them more because of aging infrastructure.
That's definitely what advocates are saying. It's much more likely to be an issue in older schools where they could potentially have lead supply lines. And even though the Sewer and Water Board, they use a calcium hydroxide, I believe, mix to kind of coat the pipes and try and help keep lead particles from escaping, if there's construction going on or other things that can shake lead particles loose, that's something that could show up in your water.
What other problems has OPSB run into with trying to remove lead from drinking water at schools?
From the beginning, this was really an example of what decentralization has looked like in the district. So they decided they were going to install filters, and then they realized they didn't know what kind of water fountains were in every school. So they had to do a survey of all the charter schools, figure out what kind of water fountains we had, how many of each type, and were these filters actually going to work on some of these really old fountains and some of the newer fountains.
So the main problem is this decentralization of the school district that has caused just logistical problems with getting this work done.
Exactly. And then, for example, like at Warren Easton, their drinking fountains were reduced to a trickle, and they just kind of, it seemed like, thought this was their own problem. And then when they finally did contact the district was like, oh, you're having problems. We're having problems other places. So it seems like there's been a little bit of lack of communication between the charters and the district.
What's been the reaction to this news?
People are very frustrated that it's taking so long to put in the filters. I talked to one parent who had moved here recently, and he was like, you know, I really, really thought that this was a city thing that would be taken care of. I can't believe I'm putting my kid in a school that where there could be lead in the pipes.
So do kids have access to safe drinking water at OPSB schools?
We don't actually know the answer to that. The district hasn't tested for lead since the late 80s, other than when they tested at Plessy. And the results at Plessy were good, so the filters are working there. But at other schools, we don't know for sure. The Sewer and Water Board says the water leaving their plant is safe, and they use what they call corrosion control, where they coat the pipes so that lead particles aren't coming out. However, like we said earlier, lead particles can shake loose during construction nearby areas.
And are schools doing anything individually, you know, providing bottled water or anything like that for kids?
When the seventh grader at Plessy had his off-the-shelf lead test come back positive for lead and or pesticides, the district immediately turned off all the drinking fountains. They brought in bottled water. And we don't believe they've brought bottled water to other schools. That's a question that they haven't been willing to answer.
What happens next here?
The district says it's going to be done installing filters by August 1st of 2019. That sounds like a pretty ambitious goal based on all these issues that we're seeing. But they say that they're going to move forward with installing booster pumps and filters in the rest of the school. So we'll see how this progresses.
Marta Jusen, thank you so much for your great reporting.
Thank you.
New Orleans legislators have been working on a trio of bills that would funnel more money from hotel tax revenue to city coffers for infrastructure repairs. A key part of the plan includes a tax increase on short-term rentals. Michael Isaac Stein has been following this story and joins me now. Michael, of the three bills in the legislature that would divert money to New Orleans for infrastructure, one bill in the House authorizes the city to place a tax on short-term rentals. How would this bill work?
If the bill passed, the tax levied would be 6.75% on short-term rentals in New Orleans. And that basically brings short-term rental taxation in line with current hotel taxes. So as it stands right now, hotels pay a larger tax on those per-night expenditures. And the revenue that would be generated from this tax, the Cantrell administration is expecting it to be about $10.5 million a year. But not all of that would go to the city. So 25% of that would go to New Orleans & Co. And then the remaining 75% would go into a special infrastructure fund. And it should be noted that even if this bill does pass, voters would have to approve it on a ballot measure before it could actually take place.
So the New Orleans City Council passed restrictions and licensing requirements on short-term rentals in recent years, and the current council is working to overhaul and tighten those requirements even further. So what impact might these restrictions have on the money that the Cantrell administration is banking on with this short-term rental tax?
So it's actually pretty interesting because if you look at the fiscal note on the bill, the Cantrell administration is actually expecting an increase in short-term rental revenue compared to 2018. And like you said, that's interesting based off the fact that City Council is poised to pass these new restrictions on short-term rentals. You know, in the story that's being published in The Lens, we go into, you know, kind of how the Cantrell administration got this number and why they're expecting a revenue increase. And When you look at the numbers that they were going by, there actually has been an increase in short-term rental revenue in the first 3 months of 2019. And there could be a few reasons for this. The two reasons that we really pinpointed, the first is that there has been a lot of growth in commercial short-term rentals. So since March of 2018, there's been a moratorium on what was the most popular type of short-term rental, which was a temporary residential permit. There were no restrictions put on commercial permits, which is, you know, maybe why we're seeing this real uptick. I mean, about 33% increase since April of last year. But, you know, as we said, I mean, if these new council restrictions pass, there are new kind of hurdles that people would need to get over to have commercial permits. So that trend might be reversed based on the council regulations.
So how are they even calculating how much money is coming in?
So the standard for calculating how much money is being spent on short-term rentals has become looking at the New Orleans Quality of Life Fund. So out of the taxes that are currently levied on short-term rentals, there's a 4% tax that goes to this New Orleans Quality of Life Fund. That's a state-controlled fund that the city can pull from, but it is controlled by the state of Louisiana. And basically, you can look at that fund and reverse engineer from that to figure out how much revenue came in. That's been our best indication so far of how much money is being spent month to month on short-term rentals. The problem with relying on that is you know, one issue that's been brought up to us by some affordable housing advocates is the fact that these taxes are collected and remitted by Airbnb. So Airbnb automatically taxes, you know, puts on these taxes on every single booking in New Orleans. The problem is that not every single booking on Airbnb is a licensed Airbnb. So a lot of these are unpermitted. I mean, the numbers vary. Jane Place, which has been a vocal critic of short-term rentals, they've claimed that, you know, over 2,000 listings on Airbnb are unlicensed in New Orleans. So when looking at the revenue that this that the proposed tax would raise, you also have to take into account the fact that the council, you know, has been talking a lot about how they need to increase enforcement. You know, if they're going to pass new restrictions, there has to be better enforcement. So if that happens, you could see a scenario where a lot of these unpermitted short-term rentals get taken off the market, and therefore less money would be going into the Quality of Life Fund. So measuring short-term rentals on based on quality of life deposits, you know, there are some inconsistencies and there are some reasons to think that by the end of the year, we'll see those go down.
Another sticking point in this conversation is the division of tax revenue between the city for municipal infrastructure projects and the tourism industry.
If you remember, this whole thing started in the fall. Mayor Cantrell launched this, you know, Fair Share campaign, where she talked about how the tourism industry was just getting too big of a chunk of hotel taxes. I mean, you know, the vast majority of hotel motel taxes go back to these tourism industry entities. And she had argued that, you know, the city needs more of this money for municipal services. And yet here is a tax that she is backing that creates yet another source of revenue, of tax revenue, going to the tourism industry. So some people look at that and kind of balk and say this flies in the face of the entire, you know, basis of what the mayor is trying to do here. You know, I'd say another issue that I think is might be at the height of why affordable housing advocates, you know, do not like this proposed tax, is that this gap between short-term rental taxes and hotel taxes, a lot of affordable housing advocates and council members were hoping to use that gap to fund affordable housing projects. So, you know, right now there's a $1 a night fee that goes to affordable housing projects. Councilmember Palmer suggested bringing that up to like $10 for small residential, $20 for large residential, and $25 for commercial. I mean, and she was expecting that to bring in about $20 million a year for affordable housing projects. And now the mayor kind of jumps into this equation and basically takes this money for infrastructure. So the way that city council members are looking at it, who have worked on this for about a year, is that they're basically just seeing a big pot of money that they were relying on basically disappear.
Yeah. How much is this issue driving a wedge between the mayor and the city council?
You know, it's even unclear how much of a wedge there is, just because I don't think the city council is getting a lot of information from the mayor. I mean, we could not get anyone to comment. And their explanations were, listen, we simply don't know enough at this point. You know, I don't think that the mayor necessarily consulted the city council. You know, and I think there's like a long-term concern here. I mean, the city council has been working for over a year on trying to change these short-term rental regulations. I mean, you know, city planning commission studies and hearings and votes. And in the next month, you know, we're looking at a very monumental vote to push this thing forward. And suddenly the mayor is getting involved. So the question becomes, you know, if this passes and infrastructure funding becomes tied to short-term rentals, will that incentivize the mayor to get involved and perhaps push for looser regulations? I mean, that's, you know, and there's not a lot of evidence to back up that the mayor is going to do that, but that is one concern that we've been hearing.
Michael Isaacstein, thank you so much.
Thanks, Jess.
On Thursday, owners of The Advocate announced they had purchased NOLA.com, the Times-Picayune. The breaking news dominated conversations around town and at Press Row in the state legislature, where reporters from both news outlets have offices. Jed Horn is a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist who served as the city editor at the Times-Picayune for many years. He's currently the opinion editor for The Lens. Jed Horn joins me now. What was your reaction when you heard Thursday's announcement that the owners of The Advocate had bought NOLA.com, the Times-Picayune?
Well, I was kind of wowed by it. It's not entirely unexpected because we have rampaging investment aggressiveness in the part of John Georges, who's a fascinating addition to the media landscape here in South Louisiana. At the same time, it's a big, big step. And there's also a certain amount of schadenfreude, I think, that a lot of people are experiencing, former employees of the Times-Picayune, to see that it has been devoured, as it were, by an upstart rival.
And the Times-Picayune obviously has had some problems over the last few years in terms of dropping down how often they publish papers during the week, laying off staff. Did you see this coming?
Well, frankly, a lot of people decided when the when Advance Publications, the owner of the Times-Picayune, refused to sell to a group that sprang forth in 2012, a local group, including Tom Benson, the Saints sports owner, to buy the Times-Picayune. When that move was rebuffed, a lot of people decided that what Advance was up to, the Newhouse family was up to, was simply riding the Times-Picayune into the ground, milking it for whatever profit it threw off, and then finally just throwing the husk into the street and leaving it at that. You know, why else, people said, would they not have accepted an offer of many millions of dollars to buy out what, by Advance's own admission, was a flailing, if not dying, institution?
You said John Georges is a fascinating addition to the media landscape in South Louisiana. Tell me a bit more about him.
Well, John Georges inherited a very lucrative business, Imperial Trading, and has made a fortune. I think Imperial grosses something like $2 billion a year or some fabulous amount of money like that, essentially supplying convenience stores with you know, their inventory, what it is they sell. Georges, who ran at one point for governor unsuccessfully, has had political ambitions along with a keen sense of capitalist competitiveness. And all of that has been animating of a media landscape that in these days you rarely see a newspaper war, but that, you know, at a time when newspapers are really just dying and consolidating, all of a sudden we had one. And it was because John Georges was interested enough to accept some losses initially and at least very marginal profits in the name of preserving local ownership of a news product.
Two things I want to talk about there, what you said. You mentioned local newspapers. We've seen local newspapers across the country either fail completely or be bought out by bigger conglomerates. I'm thinking about the USA Today network that you see pop up on all sorts of local news websites. What does this say about the state of local journalism in New Orleans?
Well, what this says about local journalism is that there's still a commitment to localism, if you will. One of the major hallmarks of the Ashton Phelps era, which is the one that preceded these decisions in 2012 when he retired to, you know, cut the paper back in terms of daily appearance and size of staff and commitment to high quality journalism. His hallmark had been local news, zoning, very specific to suburbs. There was an East Jefferson edition, there was an Upriver edition, River Parishes edition, there was a St. Bernard edition, and even New Orleans was subdivided into lakefront editions and West Bank editions and so forth. That is a very deep and expensive commitment to local journalism, which nobody else does. I don't mean to say nobody else does local journalism, but the level of the Times-Picayune's commitment was uniquely strong. Anybody can produce stories about Donald Trump, but at the school board in Slidell is a more challenging topic to staff adequately. And the Times-Picayune had found ways to do that. It's going to be very interesting to see whether the Advocate commits to keep that up. It will certainly be committed to local news in the New Orleans area. But how local, how completely zoned, how willing the advertisers are to support that level of zoning remains to be seen. That's going to be one of the things to watch as the Advocate takes over NOLA and tries really to revive it.
Yeah, articles on both the Advocate and NOLA.com's websites attributed to staff paint a positive image of this buyout, saying news, advertising, and sales operations in New Orleans will be expanded with many new positions filled by NOLA.com staff. I've been on the receiving end of a media shutdown before. It is certainly a challenging time for all of the journalists and all of the staff. And, you know, I really, on a personal note, I feel for them. Like I said, I've been there. I think if you're in this career long enough, we all have been there. But what's your take on this rosy picture that's being painted?
Well, I think you need to take it with a grain of salt. I mean, the word on the street, I don't have this authoritatively, but I think it's probably true, and you would know as well as any of us how these things play out, is that every single member of the Times-Picayune staff has been effectively laid off. They've been given notice. They have 60 days severance, if you will, and then they're gone pecans. The Baton Rouge Advocate and its New Orleans version will have the pick of those reporters that they want. Already with the largest newsroom staff of any local media product, I don't think you're going to see the Advocate taking on huge numbers of Times-Picayune employees. There's going to be more blood on the carpets, just as there had been a lot of blood in 2012. And there's going to be some very sad and unhappy Times-Picayune employees. I suspect the Advocate will favor its own when it comes to filling staff positions. But there are some prize journalists still at the at NOLA and at the Times-Picayune, and they will be offered jobs. Others will not.
Is this sort of condensing of journalism at this time a good thing for news in New Orleans? Is it better to condense or to have competition, even when some of your competition might be struggling?
Well, you certainly need to have economically viable media in any market. I mean, unless you're operating, as we do, on a nonprofit basis with support from the philanthropic community and from readers, you really, you know, you want to see a healthy newspaper. On the other hand, the competition that has existed for 7 years between the Times-Picayune and the upstart New Orleans Advocate has been invigorating. I don't think there's any question about it. John Georges has been willing to spend money in order to beat the Times-Picayune. That has made for a bigger staff than he may want to sustain. I mean, and that's the rub. I mean, you want him to succeed, but he no longer needs to be quite as competitive as he was. And the question becomes, all right, how much is he going to have to cut in order to make a return on his investment, which now is, of course, that much more large scale after buying out the competition.
As a former employee of the Times-Picayune, how does this feel from a legacy standpoint? You know, the Times-Picayune was synonymous with New Orleans. So in terms of the legacy of the Times-Picayune, what's your thought there?
Well, I think that legacy, I think they're making efforts to preserve it, at least the positive aspects of it. That I mean, the Times-Picayune was a mediocre property until the last several decades, in which it was really substantially upgraded under the editorships of Charlie Ferguson and Jim Amos. And, you know, they clearly want to sustain that tradition, that legacy. Times-Picayune at one point had, I think, the highest penetration rate, meaning more people per capita in the market read it than in most any other city in the country. I mean, it was an extraordinarily popular, as you suggest, synonymous with the kind of spirit of New Orleans. And that kind of goodwill is clearly something that the Baton Rouge advocate, the New Orleans advocate, doesn't want to squander. At the same time, I think it's safe to say that a lot of people were rooting for the advocate, because so many of the Times-Picayune people, when they were either fired or saw that what the new regime under closer management by the new houses was going to involve, walked out the door. You know, top journalists, Gordon Russell, Peter Kovacs, the editor-in-chief, Dan Shea, the now publisher of The Advocate, they went across the street and started a rival paper at a time when very few cities have two, very few cities the size of New Orleans. And those of us who thought that the houses were making a bad mistake, or in any case were degrading the glorious tradition of the Times-Picayune by cutting it back to 3 days and so on, were cheering for the Advocate, which I think remains at this point the better news product. And we hope that tradition can be sustained, even as the competition that has forced John Georges to invest a little more heavily than he might have wanted to goes away.
Opinion editor for The Lens, Jed Horn, thank you so much for joining me.
Oh, my pleasure.
That's it for this week. Thanks for listening to Behind the Lens. I'm your host, Jessica Rosegard. We'll be back next Friday. Please consider supporting nonprofit journalism in New Orleans. Go to support.thelensnola.org to make a donation today.